Welcome to episode 10 of the Dean's Podcast, the podcast about issues shaping graduate studies in Canada. This podcast is brought to you by University of Paris Magazine. My name is Carolyn Waters, and I'm the Dean of Graduate Studies at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I'm also the president of the Canadian Association of Graduate Studies, CAGS, for the year 2009. Every month, you can listen in as I talk to other deans, faculty, postdocs, and graduate students about where graduate studies is going in Canada and internationally. In this episode, I talk to my colleague, Sunny Marsh, the Associate Dean of Graduate Studies, responsible for postdocs at Dalhousie University, and a co-contributor to the Dean's blog. We speak about the role that postdoctoral fellows play at Canadian universities, the benefits they provide, and some of the challenges they face in the context of a national initiative to improve the postdoctoral experience in all of our Canadian institutions. It's an interesting discussion. But first, a message from our sponsor.
Hi, my name is Dick Sullentize, and I'm responsible for all career advertising and university affairs. Did you know that most graduate students don't know where to look for academic jobs? Simply because their supervisors haven't told them. Tell the PhDs and postdocs you advise to visit www.universityaffairs.ca for the latest job offers in every discipline. It's free, and it's updated daily.
I'm Carolyn Waters at Dalhousie University, and today I have Sunny, who's just been quoting from the Old Testament. Sunny Marsh is the Associate Dean at Dalhousie, responsible for PhD theses, what else, Sunny? ID PhD program, and today we're going to talk about the postdoctoral fellow. So welcome, Sunny.
Thank you, Carolyn.
I didn't give him time to quote from anything.
Okay. There's lots of time left, Carolyn.
Okay, so postdoctoral fellows is a hot topic in Canadian grad study circles these days. So let's just start out with what we are all talking about when we say postdoctoral fellow.
I think there's actually not all that sound and agreement across the country about what we mean by postdoctoral fellow. When we were first handed the portfolio of responsibilities at this university, I can tell you that there was quite a disparate set of definitions in place, varying from somebody who is going to be here for 2 years to somebody who is going to be here for 12. So the definition is actually not all that consistent, although the working group that we have nationally has come up with a definition that runs something like this. A postdoc fellow is intended to be a temporary work assignment, where the word temporary means not longer than 6 years.
Okay, so why do we have postdocs anyway? We make people suffer through the PhD. Is that not enough?
Apparently it isn't. I suspect that the real reason that we have postdocs is because we don't have faculty appointments. And that if there were more baby boomers retiring on time instead of dragging their heels, that this would open up more faculty positions and we would have fewer postdoctoral fellows. The second reason that we have postdoctoral fellows is that we have a very bad practice of predicting what the demand in each of the various disciplines is going to be. And it actually produces, from the perspective of faculty positions, an oversupply. So people still hold the idea that they're going to get a faculty position, and so they're prepared to continue working in the lab or wherever else until the faculty position opens up.
So what about the argument from science and medicine that the PhD is not enough, that if you're going to do this particular kind of gene slicing or use this particular kind of equipment, you actually need more study?
I'm quite sensitive to the argument, of course, because most of us have to do or undertake continuing professional development for our entire professional careers. So I don't think it's particularly remarkable that this is going to be the case for science, because science technology continues to change.
Okay, so Sunny's a business guy, so I have to ask this question. What's the value added to the university to have postdocs here?
Well, there's a huge value add because, for the most part, postdocs are paid fairly modestly, and I think I'm probably being generous in that characterization. The university gets a huge value because the postdocs act as mentors and they act as supervisors for graduate students in the labs, and they're probably not old enough to have very much in the way of a family life or children responsibilities, and so the principal investigator can delegate a lot of responsibility, and the university gets a lot of value.
So is it fair to say that much of the research enterprise is on the back of postdocs?
I would say that the research enterprise absolutely depends not just on postdocs, but PhD students and even master's students. And there's a surprising number of places, even in the academic community, and certainly well beyond, where this is not appreciated at all.
So what's the problem here? We've got these people, albeit underpaid, working in fields they want. The university benefits. The student gets more experience, more publications. Why do we have a problem?
I'm not sure that we have a problem, except that the PDFs have the problem. And that is, I think their employment prospects are not what they imagine them to be. Not more than 50% of postdocs or PhD graduates will end up in an academic organization, and fewer than 25% of the cohort will end up with a tenure-track faculty position. So that's a serious problem, which means, of course, that these people are here under kind of false expectations, when really they should be, half of them should be getting on with their lives.
Well, maybe they can get on with their lives with their PhD. So is there something we should be doing much earlier to let them know about these other opportunities?
I don't think there's any question at all about that, that being much more realistic about their employment prospects within the academy is certainly the fair thing to do. But I think it's also very important from the perspective of providing a good transition into other work environments, other research-intensive environments, whether it's a large pharmaceutical company or an engineering organization or 3M or whoever it happens to be, to help the students with that. The challenge we have with training graduate students generally and postdocs particularly is that the specific skills that we give them are almost narrowly focused on preparing them to be future faculty, when fully 50% of them won't be faculty of any kind and only 25% of them will be tenure track. So they actually do need a broader set of skills that in some respects most of the supervisors are not equipped to give them.
So Sonny's very slippery here. He slid right into the next topic. So what are we going to do to help them? What kinds of topics do we need? What sorts of resources would we need? Whose time is going to be used to do this?
The responsibility for postdoctoral fellows in this part of the world, by which I mean Canada, is for the most part in faculties of graduate studies or equivalent. And I think it belongs to those faculties to start a process of thinking clearly through what the professional development needs of postdocs are. I should point out that so the professional development needs of postdocs are not significantly different in terms of the content than the development needs for other graduate students.
Can you be a little more specific about some of the things we've talked about?
Yeah. One of the things that we did here at Dalhousie University when we first took on responsibility for professional development was we ran an internal research project in which we asked the students and graduate students what they thought their personal and professional development needs were. Then we asked the faculty members that supervised them what they thought the students' needs were. And last but not least, we asked the alumni, and it was the alumni response that was most interesting because there's a huge disconnect. So at the top of the list for alumni is public speaking, which was an enormous surprise for me. So you have to ask the question, well, aren't they getting this in high school? And the short answer is, well, yes. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But the standard of public speaking that we expect from someone who has a PhD or someone who's a postdoc is quite different than the standard of public speaking that we expect from a high school student. So providing the kinds of resources to help these people advance their competencies is a significant challenge.
So I just have to ask, what was top on the students' list and what was top on the faculty members' list?
I'm working from memory here, but I think the students was how to get scholarships, and the top of the faculties was how to write grants. So,
how about writing papers?
Oh, yeah, well, writing papers was up there, too, which is also a little bit on the alarming side, mm-hmm. because one would think that after 12 years of secondary school, 4 years of undergraduate, that most of our students would have presumably acquired the necessary writing skills. And it isn't the case. It is also the case that the standard to which they have to be able to write is quite different. So that's an ongoing issue.
And we'll leave that for another day. But getting back to our original topic, what have you been, you've been involved in the national level here in Canada. Do you want to talk a little bit about how this is going nationally?
Well, we've had one major meeting nationally to just review what the issues are and what the various positions are. The good news is that there is quite a significant community of souls around the table representing vastly different constituencies. We have representatives from the Canadian Association of Postgraduate Scholars, which is the PDF's kind of advocacy group. We have the Canadian Association of Graduate Studies, of which you're the president, is at the table. The Association of Universities and Colleges of Canada, the Canadian Association of University Business Officers, NSERC, SHRC, CIHR, among others. So that's been very helpful to have that discussion around the table. And I think that we can be encouraged that everybody around the table has a significant understanding about how serious of an issue the PDF question in Canada is. We've had the first meeting, and we've cobbled together an initial definition of PDFs that we hope will be used everywhere in Canada. And we're going to have another meeting, if I can find the time to organize it for this fall, in which to perhaps establish best practices or at least some kind of policy framework that we can carry forward to our respective organizations to get a collective agreement about how to deal with them.
So something I've always been interested in is the notion of a framework of these professionals' development skills that would apply to all universities everywhere in some kind of cooperative way. As Janice Deacon from the Queen's University says, they're training our new professors and we're training their new professors, so we might as well cooperate. Has anything been done on what kinds of topics we would be talking about?
We haven't actually talked about the professional development needs of PDFs yet. We have rather more fundamental questions, such as the working relationship between the PDF and the principal investigator and the institution. So there's a big question about whether it ought to be an employment relationship, or it ought to be a training and development relationship, or is it a research productivity relationship? So we have to work through that issue. The question of professional development skills. Now, you said specifically that we're training their faculty and they're training our faculty. That's only true for 25% of them.
Right.
You know, somebody has to be worried about the other 75% of them. And I think that's a topic for another day, the whole question about what is an appropriate suite of skill development for graduate students more generally.
Right. And let's go back to a little bit about this notion of the postdoc as an employee versus mm-hmm. as a training. How's that playing out here? Is it the same picture across the country, or is it very localized?
I think the practices are highly variable. We take an approach here that pays careful attention to the policies and practices of the federal government around taxation. So one of the reasons that the whole PDF portfolio has become much more serious is that the last major budget, I think it was 3 years ago, from at the national level, changed the policy around taxation of fellowships, in which it used to be only the first $3,000 was tax-free, and now it's all fellowship scholarship stipends are tax-free. But there is a proviso, And the proviso in both the legislation and their related interpretation bulletin says that it really depends on the working relationship between the PDF and the supervisor. And if that relationship is primarily developmental and educational in nature, then the fellowship is tax-free. If you're just there to be research productivity and to supervise the rablats, that's a whole other matter, and that doesn't actually fall under the tax-free category.
So can we have some who are employees and some who aren't?
Well, frankly, the general rule is that if you're a PDF, you're not an employee, by definition. If you're an employee, then you're a research associate. So, again, this is our local policy and local interpretation, but there are some significant variations across the country.
What about benefits and maternity leaves and things like that if you're a research fellow, rather than a research fellow?
You said research fellow. I think you meant research associate. Yeah. If you're a research associate and you're an employee, you get benefits. And among those benefits is payment into CPP and employment insurance, as well as your taxation. And typically you get the other benefits such as life insurance on the job and those kinds of things. If you are a PDF, by definition you're not an employee and you don't have access to benefits. So this is a real problem because a number of our PDFs, in fact more and more of our PDFs, are female, and they usually are PDFs in the sort of prime pregnancy years between, let's say, 26 and 34. And if you're a PDF and you get pregnant, well, that's a bit of a problem because it really is up to your PI about whether you're going to have any kind of ongoing support while you're pregnant. So one of the things we're trying to do here is to organize some kind of other alternative access to the benefits that would provide these kinds of coverages to life's events.
So this is somewhat ironic, actually. Someone who's a graduate student doing their PhD has more access to benefits than does a postdoc who has made the milestones. So what is the postdoc association saying about all this?
Well, I think I hesitate to speak for other people to begin with. But
what have they been telling you?
What have they been telling me? I think many postdocs would actually prefer an employment status, but not at the expense of losing their tax-free status. So that's kind of like squaring the circle there. My own view is that I really think, in any practical sense, they are employees, given the standard kind of test for whether you're an employee, for example, is whether you set your own hours and whether you have your own equipment and whether you're the person who's deciding what gets to be done. And you know what? That's just not the case for most PDFs.
It might be in the social sciences and humanities, so there might be some disciplinary differences here.
There might be, but I think that's not a good place to go. In the end, I think what I'd like to see, I do understand the federal government's inclination to support the early career evolution of scientists postdoctoral. The unfortunate thing is it's produced some very odd, unanticipated consequences. We have a PhD. We now have some PhD students, for example, who have major scholarships. They might have a major scholarship of, if they have a Vanier, it's $50,000 a year, tax-free, and then they become PDFs. Now they're better qualified than when they were students, and they might get a $45,000 PDF, so they've just gotten a $5,000 reduction in salary as a consequence of getting qualified for 3 years, because that's the maximum amount of time at this university when we permit people to be an academic PDF. And if they continue in their PDF stream after that, they are called research PDFs, which means they're taxable. They still don't get any benefit. So the after-tax benefit is now, as a Vanier scholar, you had $50,000. As an academic PDF, you had $45,000 after-tax because there is no tax. And now here you are, a research PDF, and you're even better qualified, and you're going to take home less money. Then you compare that to the research associate who's working beside you on the same bench, and you have this mishmash of a combination of compensation practices that in any other place that I've come from in the business world would not be tolerated for 2 minutes.
Do you think this will lead to unionization of the students?
There has been some of that, but I think for the most part it hasn't been all that successful in terms of resolving these questions. So what I would like to see, although I'm only one of 15 voices at the table, is I'd like to find some way in which we can have PDFs, their work respected and compensated appropriately, especially through access to benefits, because the benefits that we buy collectively are cheaper than the benefits you buy individually. And if the federal government wants to support these young scholars, as I think they should, we have to help the federal government find other ways than just a straight tax-free status.
So do you think we're in a period of credential creep here? So it used to be a PhD, you had a PhD, your hot stuff, off you went, and now we're running into you have to have a 2 or 4 year postdoc before you become hot stuff and people will hire you in places, or do you think it's just it's one of these cycles we're going up and down?
Well, I think in this specific case, I think it is discipline dependent. So I think, for example, if you're a Shakespeare scholar and you score a killing PDF, that having had a PDF is not going to enhance your particular skills at all. You might get a couple of publications that might help your case. In the case of chemistry or some of the other hard sciences, there is gradually becoming this credential creep where there's the expectation that a person will have 2 or 3 years of postdoctoral training before they're, quote, fully qualified.
Yeah, that certainly happened in computer science. Until 5 or 6 years ago, hardly anybody had a postdoc, and now everybody's sort of looking around for postdocs, which I suspect is a matter of how many positions in what areas are open. So where are we going to go from here, Sonny?
Well, we have to get the 15 people around the table again and go the next step about prioritizing or setting the priority around the factors that are going to contribute to the success of PDFs. And then I think we have to carry the discussion forward to the federal government on the tax policy front and possibly even on the scholarship front. And maybe even change the kinds of expectations that the granting councils have around what a PDF is for.
So how do you propose going about that? Having like the presidents of the universities go to Ottawa through CAGS, with students? Like, what would your little strategy for getting this at the level of the federal government?
Boy, I hesitate to send the presidents off to do this.
We might have to edit this.
No, just simply because I don't expect the presidents to have a very deep understanding of this issue. In order to move the whole topic forward, I think it's critical to have all the different communities of interest, like the granting councils and the business officers and CAGS and everybody else, agree on the fundamental principles, and if we can get some kind of general agreement around best practices for managing and administering postdoctoral fellows, then each of those communities can take forward the argument through whatever mechanisms they have, touch points they have with the federal government, and the combination of all these various touch points with a single message will actually achieve some positive outcomes.
Now, for something practical, when this group comes up with best practices, where would we be able to find them?
Well, I in some respects, I think we will be inventing them at the table.
But are they going to be on a website someplace?
Oh.
Or
no, I mean,
T-shirts?
No, I just... That would be a large T-shirt, I'm pretty sure.
Sonny's bigger than me.
I'm not big enough, but my T-shirt would not be big enough to contain the text for best practices. I think what we should be doing is that if we come to an agreement around this, especially if all of the different pieces have alignment, so that SHRC and NSERC and CIHR articulate their expectations around PDFs in a way that shapes the behavior of the universities, then we'll get much better coherence. So in the United Kingdom, as an example, the granting council there says to all of the organizations that benefit from their funding, by the way, we expect you to invest in the professional development of these students. And this is what we mean by professional development. And if you don't do it, you're not getting the funding. So, needless to say, there is a substantially higher level of postdoctoral and graduate student professional development work that's being done in the UK than there is in Canada.
Okay, more work to be done. So that's the last word from Mr. Postdoc in Canada, Sunny. Thanks, Sunny.
You're welcome.
That's it for this episode. If you'd like to get in touch with me about something you heard on this podcast or about an issue that you'd like to see covered, please email me at carolyn.waters@dal.ca. You can also leave a comment at the bottom of the page where this podcast is posted at universityaffairs.ca. Until next time, I'm Carolyn Waters, and thanks for listening.